If you can turn to the presentation that we have on effects analysis, I'm just going to walk through some of the work that we've been doing over the last 6 or 8 months and hopefully tee up some of the questions that we're going to discuss as a group. I must say I was particularly pleased to hear all the feedback that came back from the last session. Doesn't matter what we do, we're going to please somebody because the views are a little bit divergent, but it's actually very helpful input, and I'm hoping we're going to get the same from the effects analysis. So if we have a look at a little bit of the background of where we've come from, we've always considered costs and benefit for all the time we've been setting standards. But in April 2007, we made that far more explicit in our framework, and we started to use the words effects analysis, impact assessment we used initially, but the effects analysis is we've embedded in our language. The Advisory Council recommended at the time that we should develop a methodology for effects analysis, and the handbook now embeds that in 2013. Now, the big thing was that the trustees recommended that we set up and establish a consultative group that we chair, the ISB chairs, to actually try to develop a consistent methodology, and we formed that group in March of this year. Even though the purpose of the group is to develop a shared methodology, you'll see when we go into the next slides, the first thing you have to agree on is what effects are you trying to consider, because there's no point having a methodology until you understand the problem you're trying to solve. I need to make a very clear disclaimer, however. The group's met twice. We meet in public. The recordings are available for anybody to listen to. It's scheduled to meet again in November. So far, we have a draft report that's about 63 pages long. I expect the final report to be closer to 100 pages. It's quite comprehensive in the issues it considers, and our draft report does include some indicative wording of recommendations that will be made coming out of the processes. However, the group has not reached a consensus on this, so any indicative any direction that I give you is not necessarily, you can't go back and say the group's decided, okay? So I need to make that very clear. In fact, the material I'm giving you now is from the draft report that we will be discussing in November. So it's formed on what we've heard from our discussions, but we certainly can't attribute to the group at this stage. Okay, so if we have a look, really there are two parts of types of questions that we're going to look at today. The first is around what we do, what's our business as the ISB, and what somebody else's. And so it's really the scope of an effects analysis. And the second part is a little bit around process or methodology. So when we set up the effects analysis consultative group, as I said, even though it's about getting an agreed methodology, we have to ask what the problem is first. And that means stepping back a little bit and asking, what's the purpose of doing an effects analysis? And I've said this many times, and I think the group kind of agrees, it's actually kind of a simple question. Essentially, what's happening is that the ISB is coming along and saying, you know what, I think there's a problem with some aspect of financial reporting, and we think we need to fix it. We want to make an improvement. So we've got some choices about what direction we take. I'm not going to discuss leases today, but I'll use that as a couple of examples. We think there's a problem. There's a lot of debt off-balance sheet, hidden leverage. We think we need to address that. Okay? So that's really is the first type of issue that we're addressing. Then we have to go through and we're trying to demonstrate to people, not just regulators, but to preparers and others, demonstrate that we've understood the problem and we've identified a good solution, cost-beneficially good, and we understand the implications of that solution. And we can explain to you why it's better reporting. We can explain to you why it's worthwhile for companies to go and change their systems to get a better answer. It's worthwhile explaining why the investors have to change their models and spreadsheets because we're going to give them different information. But that's okay. It's worthwhile doing because we've got a better answer for you. That's really essentially what we do in terms of trying to justify the standards. So there's nothing stunning or new in that. We do that on the basis for conclusions. A lot of this is about the language and the types of effects we might want to consider. Now, in that first slide, you'll see this is about the processes for considering and communicating. What I found really informative with the consultative group is that we had people sit there and say things like, well, we think you should consider talking to groups like the Financial Stability Board. We say, we do. Because what happens is that we do so much. If anybody wants to read a basis for conclusions, they're hundreds of pages along sometimes. We don't report anything to do with the consultations with the Financial Stability Board in those basis for conclusions, but you'll find it on our website if you go to, I think, the due process section and get the reports there. So a lot of materials around. We do a lot of things that the group was asking us to do, but the way we communicate, and you'll see it on the last slide, it's very important that we provide people with an easy summary of the likely effects of a standard and what consultations we've undertaken. So communication was very, very important. People didn't understand that we were doing a lot of these things anyway, just because we were reporting them in different places. Basically, I guess the first thing we asked is, what are the needs of users and regulators? And you'll see very quickly, you know, one that keeps coming up is financial stability versus, in our case, talking about transparency. Okay, so we're trying to identify what our job is, what we're good at, what we have a comparative advantage in doing, and what others have a comparative advantage. I think it's arguable, and that's a theme through the recommendations are developing, is that we're all about trying to produce good information, transparent information to help investors make decisions. There are others who are better qualified to judge how our changes we make will affect financial stability, will affect taxation basis, and so on. We have to ask a question whether we should be making those assessments or helping others, in other words, facilitating them by providing information to do their job. I think that's the theme that we've got throughout there. We should do what we are good at, and that is we should be looking at the effects as they relate to the objective of financial reporting, the needs of investors, and let others do their job. It doesn't mean we ignore their job, and there are a couple of recommendations that we think will come out of the report in relation to that. So if we go and have a look at the purpose of an effects analysis, said it's to help the ISB assess the effects of alternative approaches, including should we even do something? One of the things we've been asked to make sure we do is have a look and justify. People have been producing information potentially for 20, 30 years. We're going to come along and change it. Is the change itself justified? So we should be testing against the status quo, not just looking at two alternative models, for example, but looking at what happens if we do nothing. Okay? Because to do something, you have to improve the financial reporting in a cost-beneficial way. We want to help people get a better understanding of what we've done and what we've thought about. Quite often people will say to the ISB, have you considered this? Well, the answer is yes, we have, and it's about us communicating that in a very clear way. And in particular, that last bullet point, if somebody else is responsible for, and I'll be the provocative issue again, is financial stability, what we need to be very clear about how far we are able to go, not so much prepared, but able to go, so they understand that they're going to have to do something extra. We had a look around. Lots of different jurisdictions have got different mechanisms for endorsing standards and different tests. We can't design a system that meets every single person's needs. But if they understand how far we're able to go, what information we will provide as an input to their processes, they can plan for that and actually start to do their extra bits by themselves. What we're trying to do is get some duplication out of the system. We don't want us doing one thing and a jurisdiction coming along and having to repeat that as well. So I think by having a clear framework, we'll understand everybody's responsibilities and we won't have an expectation gap. That's very, very important to us. So one of the issues is scope. As I said, we're concerned about transparency. The sorts of things that we look at, and the handbook sets these out, are things like the effect on the financial statements. In fact, we skipped straight to the example on leases. We would have a look to see and make sure that we understand what will happen to financial statements when, if leases come onto the balance sheet, operating leases, for example, non-cancellable. We've done some work to illustrate the type of field work that we do. We've done some work looking at analyst estimates of leverage based on that we know the adjustments they make compared to the way the numbers would be calculated under the new standard. And the range of differences, the error rate, if I can call it that, is very high. And that there is quite a significant difference where sometimes they overestimate the liability, more often than not underestimate the liability using their rule of thumb. And so we're starting to collect evidence that simple adjustment procedures made by investors or analysts are not as accurate if you look at the model that we're trying to introduce. So that's the type of thing we look at. So we understand that leverage will increase. We have a look at things like behavioural aspects and capital requirements and bank covenants. We understand that that a lot of banks, for example, have contracts that rely on IFRS numbers. Now, the fact that those exist doesn't mean we shouldn't change the standard. It's about us communicating clearly and early enough so that banks are able to adjust. When you think about it, Europe and New Zealand and Australia in 2005 all seemed to cope with a massive switch from their own standards to IFRS because they would work with the banks with those changes. Okay, so we used to call it rolling gap. It was a heck of a big turn on the wheel to go from the previous gap to IFRS, but people do cope with that as long as they've got enough advance notice, and so communication is important here. We look at compliance cost of repairs. What is it, the impairment model? Can they actually collect the information or are they going to have to run parallel systems? I've just been looking at the due process paper on the macro dynamic hedging model. The idea is to get the accounting that allows them to use existing information systems rather than have to run a parallel one just for accounting. Okay, so compliance costs are important. We look at costs of analysis for users. Where is it that a company has got an advantage in preparing information versus an analyst? So all of those things are factors in there in terms of looking at the effect of a standard. We know how it reshapes the financial statements. We understand the system changes, the costs. We hopefully also understand what new information is going to be potentially revealed, so there's a competitive aspect. So, and we say, yes, it's worthwhile doing that because the improvements are beneficial to investors as a whole. As I said, we're interested in economic behavioural effects as well. We don't want our accounting standards introducing accounting volatility that's not underpinned by economic volatility, but we've always said that there is economic volatility, accounting should reflect that. We don't want to smooth over things when there is a real underlying volatility. Okay. The other thing we acknowledge and is shaping up in the report is that we do understand, and it depends on which country you go to, but financial reports, IFRS financial reports, are used by many people, regulators, they're in bank contracts. Where I come from, a long way from here, there are at least two aspects, I think, of tax law. If you had a capital lease for accounting purposes, that's how you had to account for it for tax purposes. If you research and development, however you did it for accounting purposes, that's how you deduct it for tax purposes. You've got the LIFO connection in the US. You've got lots of little nuances around the place. Initial view that I have in particular, and I think it's emerging in the group, is that it's not up to us to understand all of those things. The board shouldn't be expected to know what the New Zealand taxation system is. However, the taxation, the people in New Zealand might want to understand that. We're going to need to rely a lot on national standard setters if they think it's important to spread that information out. And when we introduced IFRS in New Zealand, the New Zealand standard setter set up meetings with banks to talk about effects on covenants. Set up meetings with the Inland Revenue Service equivalent to talk about the effects and changes in the tax base and things like that. And so they took responsibility at a local level of helping communicate. And I think that we're going to have to rely on those standard setters to do that for us, because otherwise you'd be asking the ISB to understand every time an IFRS or statements are incorporated in some system somewhere. Now, there will be a slight exception to that. And that is when we deal with quite global things. And we've already got this in the due process handbook, but things like financial stability, we do acknowledge that accounting information is used by banking regulators. And so we think it's important we maintain dialogue with them. We do now. We meet regularly. Hans is a member of the Financial Stability Board. And so we have a lot of mechanisms in place to do this. But at the moment, our recommendation as it's developing is not for us to say that it is our responsibility for financial stability. Our responsibility is to make sure those who are the Financial Stability Board and others who look after bank regulation, they are aware of what we're doing. And so there are things like if we know that we're going to affect leverage significantly, We need to communicate that early in the process, and we do that. And the only thing that we're potentially looking at is to formalise that a little bit more so that we acknowledge that in our basis for conclusions and our reports about what steps we've taken to keep people informed. Now, the first four questions we have relate mainly to that, because we're asking you to have a look in questions 1 to 4 about, you know, what's the scope? What's our responsibility? What's the responsibility of people like, for example, Financial Stability Board? When we set standards, and this is where the language is very important, should we consider financial stability? Now, I've heard that said a lot. I'm not quite sure what consider means, because consider could mean you have to be aware of it and communicate, or it could mean, yes, we believe it affects stability, and we're not, and so therefore we shouldn't do the job, put the standard in place. The way the report's developing, it's more likely to say that it's not our job to monitor banks or to set financial stability models in place. That's up to others, but it's very important that we communicate that. And so we're asking you whether or not you agree that we should limit the scope of effects analysis to really the role of financial reporting, which is about transparency. We've got another couple of questions, again, about just involving other standard setters and whether it's reasonable for us to rely on national standard setters to communicate to their local constituents. Now, if we just move on to methodology, this is at the practical level for us. And again, and it was actually nice to hear, and I hope this theme comes out again from the last discussion, proportionality is very important to us. In that, what I was pleased we didn't hear from the last discussion is that you must have an implementation group for every standard. It's all about doing what's necessary in a particular standard, okay? And in this case, in a particular phase of a project. We think that when we start a project and the agenda consultation, in other words, starting to identify whether we should do some research on something, we don't really have to consider the effects, because at that stage we're just trying to understand the problem a lot better. But in the discussion paper, we should identify quite clearly what we think the problem is and make an assessment as to whether or not we should change accounting or whether or not we should just leave as the status quo. And I think that's the good thing. Because we redesigned our processes so that research has got a bit more importance up front and problem definition, and that's a very important piece for us, because, you know, I've said many times we're very good at presenting solutions, but the first thing you've got to do is agree on what the problem is. And that's really what that discussion phase is about. As we get into exposure draft, you want more and more detailed assessments of what the change is like to be. And that's usually to demonstrate that we understand what the implications are, how big a change we're going to make to financial statements. And then obviously, if there's a big change to financial statements, it will trickle down for other people like banking, covenants, and so on. And really, it's the final standard that is the most important bit, because by then, you've actually justifying your last bit of choice. And that's what this should be about. Post-implementation review, to me, is almost like saying, we predicted what the likely effects are. Now we're going to go back and have a look and see how accurate we were. Okay? Often, as we said with post-implementation review development, we can't go back, if we assess that it was an easy transition process and we were wrong, we can't go back and fix it, but we can learn from that. So we think it should reflect the stage of the project. The last little bit is it's methodology, and there's some tricky things. This is not, I hope this comes across positive, but we have to take information we receive cautiously. And this is, I think it's just human nature. When we had a look at the original cost or expected cost of transition in Canada, and this is from the survey and the analysis that was done for us, I think people's expectations of the likely cost were a lot higher than they actually turned out to be. And we've seen that in anecdotal examples where people talk about, well, I think it's going to be significant changes. Then systematically they go through and they're not quite as bad as they thought they were. And we have found that when you're looking at likely costs of implementation of standards, we're not sure how faithfully representational they are of what the likely outcome is going to be. So we have to think very carefully about the sources of information and how we test things. Now, two things that are a major issue for us, and it's really the third major bullet point there about the evidence. We have quite an issue, I think. I call it data integrity. But one of the problems we have is that the really meaningful work you do, and I think our impairment team has done a tremendous job. They've gone out to 14, I think it is, banks and corporates and done a significant amount of testing about our new impairment model. We know that in one particular case, one of the organisations involved spent over 600 hours of time going through analysing data. Another one spent over 500 hours. Now, we learn a lot from that. It's a very deep analysis and very, very helpful to us. But you can only do that at later stages because nobody's going to spend that much time on sort of a possibility in the process. You're not going to get many people volunteering to spend 600 hours of their time. And I said there are 14 of these organisations or entities. I can't tell you who they are because virtually all of them only participated on condition that we don't reveal who they are because of price sensitivity information. So we've got this dilemma all the time. The more meaningful work and analysis we do often ends up being relatively small in terms of sample size, and it has to be kept confidential. You know, we've got one entity wouldn't even let us reveal what country they were in, let alone what the name of the entity was. So we've got to be very careful with the demographics where we describe it. Now, that makes it difficult because in some jurisdictions, they're only allowed to consider, when they look at endorsement purposes, they can only consider information that they have seen or been involved in. And we can't give it to them. We can only give them a high-level summary of the outputs, same summaries that we present in public, for example, on impairment. And so we have this challenge all the time. And so what happens is you get work getting repeated in different places. Now, it's not always that bad because we've got some excellent work going on, EFRAG in particular. When we do some field work with EFRAG, we'll go along and they'll go along, or else they'll set up the field work and we'll help participate or share in some of the outputs. But we can't do that in every case. So we're struggling a little bit with that. And I guess we either find a solution or we persuade the jurisdictions to accept the outputs. So one of the questions we've got in here is what sort of governance do we put around that? Or do you think that, in fact, as long as we're as open as we can, we should try and persuade the jurisdictions to be more accepting of some of the evidence that we collect? Okay? That's probably one of our toughest issues. And then the last little bit is about communication. The two themes that have come out consistently is that, and it's reflected in our handbook now, people want us to embed the thinking about effects, the thinking about cost benefits all the way through the process. Don't just sit there, you know, we get accused of locking it, you know, being a little bit ivory tower and coming up with a theoretical solution, but we do consider the effects in all phases of the project. And so the best way for us to represent that is to embed that in the basis for conclusions. The problem is, go back to that dilemma. I can't remember. We've got one basis for conclusions on, I think the revenue leases one might be 230 pages or something like that. I'll get that number wrong, but it's a very, very long document. And if you speak to the people who look after in jurisdictions where they have endorsement processes, they just shake their head and say, I can't work with that. It's too long. And it doesn't always have the information expressed in the way that they need for their inputs. So we have to, I think, ultimately we're going to have to do both. We have to demonstrate sufficiently in our basis that we have been thinking about this through the whole process, and that goes back to the discussion papers and the EDs, but ultimately we should have a special report that summarises the effects that people can pick up. The challenge again is that, and to go back to those 14 companies or entities that helped us with impairment, I can't say exactly where they come from, but some were from Europe, some were not from Europe. And if you were, I don't like to pick on Europe all the time, but if you're doing a European endorsement, we've asked them the question, are those other ones outside of Europe actually relevant to your endorsement processes? Because if you're asked to simply endorse in relation to Europe, do you consider how a South American, North American, Asian bank, for example, how the impairment model affects them? So, and if we're doing a summary report, we're doing a global report. And so we have to be comfortable that what we do is going to meet the needs of as many people as we can. So it goes back to the opening slides. What's important for us is to lay out very clearly what the boundaries of our work are, what the boundary of our report is, so that others know what they're going to expect. They put a lot of credibility onto it, but then they also know what they might need to do locally to supplement that. So our last questions are all about a little bit about how can we try and reduce duplication in the system and work with others, for example, in a practical way, or what should our expectations be at the ISB about how jurisdictions might handle our reports. So I'm hoping that you'll have a nice, challenging debate in there.
Thank you for that, Alan. Any questions or comments of Alan regarding the background information that we're going to discuss in the breakouts, Begonia?
Yes, well, thank you very much for the very interesting paper that you presented, Alan. And I had a question about is the idea of publishing this effect analysis only at the end, only when the standard is approved, or would it be interesting or useful to provide the results of your evaluation in advance in order to provide arguments to those that are critics with the standard in order to communicate how this is how it's going to be useful for the users, not so costly for the superiors, etc.?
I think we're learning as we go, and I think what you've described is exactly what we've done with leases. There's an excellent analysis that's gone with that. In fact, Ada did most of the work on it, and that it's the effect analysis is built into the basis for conclusions. But that also gave us a bit of cause to pause a bit because we've got a whole lot of little scenarios and graphs and calculations and things that are part of that. And without wanting to get back to the argument about is it on the website or not, we end up, if we're not careful, of a 500-page analysis, and we're not quite sure how helpful that is to people. So, but we actually have effects built into the analysis on leases and the exposure draft. So there's an example. We've actually started to work that into the processes, and I think you'll find that happens a lot more in the standards. You'll see specific headings to try and draw people to our summary of the effect, likely effects. What I'm talking about for that last little one, it's more likely to be, I hate to talk about page numbers, but something like a 30-page report rather than a 300-page basis for conclusions, where it summarizes everything and draws from the basis for conclusions. Nothing new, just a summary that we've drawn out of this.
We want you to have a high-level discussion, but if you find it helpful, I do have a printout of the actual leases effect analysis if you want to refer to it during the discussion.
I see two cards up, Jeff and then Francois.
Thanks. Just a question. I apologize. I don't have the framework in front of me, but looking at question one, the ISB effects analysis focuses on the needs of those users identified in the conceptual framework. What are the users identified in the framework? I apologize.
It's about the provision of capital, basically, and that it's the users are investors and people who provide finance to a business. And I won't have the right terms. I can look it up, but essentially it's about transparency meeting investor needs. And really, the first question is the fundamental one that we keep coming across. People say, but no, you've got a responsibility for financial stability as well. And we're saying, well, our job is investor needs. We think the effects should be focusing on those.
Francoise.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Alan, for progressing this subject. A few points, first of all, on the issue of scope. Of the effect analysis. This was considered in the position paper that was issued by the EFRAG and the UK ASB 2 years ago, and that was supported by 15 standard setters in Europe. And basically, in that paper, the analysis is just the one that you made with the ISB, so the standard setter, more particularly responsible for the effects on financial reporting, but having to be interested to consider other possible effects in order to liaise and coordinate with whoever the relevant authorities are that need to take into account the effect. So I think the position has not changed. It's not something that could prevent from changing financial reporting, but certainly can be, first of all, an accounting solution is not necessarily unique. So you may have one other that is efficient from a financial reporting perspective and that doesn't have the same effect, or you delay the effective date or any other solution. So we are aware that the ISB coordinates with the Financial Stability Board, with regulators and the like, and we cannot do more than encourage that this continues. Probably the some form of feedback statement of this coordination should surface probably more clearly, because in a way the way the ISB informs itself, every aspect tends to be diluted in the analysis, not necessarily be identified as such. The other point I wanted to make, I think it's very important, and I'm very pleased that you have taken the LEAS project example, because I think the LEAS project shows that there is really something going on at the ISB that was not done before. So my first recommendation from a communication perspective would be to emphasize this change rather than make it less apparent. As you know, we support the fact that proportionate effort in effect analysis takes place at every stage of the standard setting process, as was reflected on your slide. The third point, and you know that very well coming from us, I mean, is that we don't think that it is a communication issue. More transparency with more publications of feedback statements is certainly something to be done to help. But what we really believe in is in a form, it's more a question of procedure, of process. And you know, we believe, and many in the accounting standard set of world believe in some form of shared due process. So it's not the ISB doing the job and eventually sharing the results. It's really the ISB taking the initiative so that it's a coordinate effort with homogeneous conclusions to the benefit of the international standard setting process which are derived. But every jurisdiction at regional, national level, it may depend, that is really invited to participate, and some will participate, some maybe will not.
Francoise, you're making many excellent points, but you're straying into topics that I thought we were being prompted to debate in the breakout. So.
Oh, sorry, I forgot that we're in the breakout. So I keep my comments. I will share them with the group.
All right, it was very on point, but perhaps a bit premature. All right, thank you for that, Alan. I think what we will do, we